Spider. So we don't read each other that much. Oh, yeah, I didn't answer that, and I do wonder. He's excluded because he's very difficult to digest, and the powers that be still kind of hate him. Henry Miller was never accepted the way he should have been. I mean, my God, in my mind, I think Henry Miller, the real argument is, of these three writers, Hemingway, Faulkner, and Henry Miller, who was the greatest? Now, I'd probably end up saying that Hemingway and Faulkner were greater than Henry Miller, but I think that's the real argument, is which of those three is the greatest. Henry Miller's never mentioned in that category. He's never taken seriously. He's a fantastic writer, but he was outside the pale. And Burroughs is like that. He's outside the pale. His work is too extreme, too revolting for some, too indigestible for others, too hard to understand for others. And Burroughs himself is too much of an enigma for critics. And but I think he will see more and more attention, you know, 20, 30, 50 years from now. Okay, two more questions and we pack it in. Yes, sir. You have to speak louder, please.
A great deal of time spent this evening discussing Mr. Rushdie in his book. I doubt very much any books are written these days that don't give offense to somebody. I witnessed a number of people that are trying to borrow very, very simple books from the libraries. So Mr. Rushdie is not exceptional in that sense. And the question is raised by a gentleman here about society's right to protect itself against libel. But from the other point of view, there are two personalities involved. Rushdie is rather one of the mass, one of the writers who's given offense, let's say. Though we apologize, I must bring the record upon that. Would you comment on the gentleman who put out a contract for this man's life? Do you think that a person who is the head of a religion would comment on that aspect?
All right. Well, to begin with, I think you can't say that the Rushdie case is similar to all the other cases. Because in no other case, if they said we're going to kill the writer, and not only we're going to kill the writer, but we're not even going to do it for love. We're going to do it for love and money. You know, that's what's extraordinary. That maybe there were writers who were, where the word was sent out, kill them. And maybe there have been writers killed. There probably have been a few. But there's been no case ever where not only was it going to be killed, but the sum was prodigious. So that the imagination of the world was shivered by the fact that this could even be conceived of. It was so completely off the notion of how established leaders act that it was beyond the pale. As far as the Ayatollah Khomeini goes, I would rather not have to start thinking of him as Satan incarnate and the essence of all evil, because he has his story too. And from his point of view, what happened is for 30 years, he lived under the threat of assassination. First from the Shah and Savak, and given his mentality, I'm not going to say that the CIA was also part of it, but they could have been on the edges of it. I think part of his vast hatred of America may come from his belief, whether right or wrong, that the CIA was trying to kill him systematically for these last 30 years. So I think he may have had an old man's bitter humor in all of this. He may have said to himself, this guy Rushdie is so tough. Let's give him 30 years of what I went through and we'll see how tough he is. You know, now it may be that he did the best thing in the world for Rushdie. Rushdie may be that tough. 30 years from now, Rushdie may be a world leader. We don't know how these things turn out. But the idea that the Ayatollah Khomeini is the origin of all the evil in the world, I think is a fruitless point of view. Because he, like every one of us alive, just about, there may be a few exceptions like Hitler, but just about every one of us alive does have our tale to tell. And Khomeini has his, which is that he lived under the threat of assassination, so he tends to think that way. Now, as far as what the gentleman was saying about libel, I don't think libel is where the problem is at all.
Sir, may I amplify?
You have to speak clearly, though, because I can't hear you. You have to speak in a few words. Just give me your idea. Allow me my intelligence. Give me your idea, and I will know what you're saying pretty much, I think.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So far, I'm asking about mechanism.
About what?
The mechanism.
Immaculatism.
Mechanism.
Mechanism.
The system.
A mechanism, all right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which will balance the so-called freedom for information and misinformation, or in the United States, we have the code of law for libel. For in the world, if some writer intended to smear or write something disgraceful or not very nice to a certain institution, what is their way of address the grievance instead of
all right, okay.
I got the idea. Contract for life?
Yeah, I got the idea. The answer is that it's interesting that I couldn't understand you before, because now what I can say to you is there's no answer for what you want. To create such a mechanism would be a disaster. One, it couldn't be enforced. Two, it would be open to incredible corruption. You know, if a publisher wanted to get something across that was verboten, he would just bribe somebody, one of the people who decided these things, and you'd end up having literary judges who are just as corrupt as the old Tammany judges used to be. Now, it's a process. The process of the freedom of literature, when writers write things that are extreme, or difficult, or dangerous, or sacrilegious, they run into all the natural resistances of society. You don't need the mechanism. There are 1,000 mechanisms already in place. One of the mechanisms is a very simple one. They will print anything in America, but in what quantity? We do here the same thing the Soviet Union does very crudely and harshly, which is the Soviet Union will print 5 million copies, at least the Soviet Union as of 5 years ago, and back into the past, would print 5 million copies of a totally nugatory pro-Stalinist novel, you see, and if you had a difficult poet who was saying a few dangerous things, they might print 2,000 copies in bad type with smudged ink. You see, so the copies were almost illegible, or there'd be typos, or this or that. There were ways of punishing writers. They didn't send everyone off to a slave labor camp, they punished them. Well, the same thing goes on here. It's very easy. Most writers are kept down, 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 way down on the farm. You learn very early that if you want to say a lot of things that are difficult and dangerous, you run to all sorts of obstacles. And some of them are subtle, psychological. There's the mechanism of ridicule. If you write something and it isn't really hitting its target, it's just abusive, you not only get bad reviews, but you've left a bad odor. You're looked upon as too extreme, as silly. We even had great writers who've run into huge resistance. We just spoke of two of them, Henry Miller and William Burroughs. They got nowhere compared to their talent because of the fact that they were offensive to too many people. So it isn't that you need a mechanism. We have all that. The problem is that there may be too many mechanisms, too much inner censorship, and that after the Rushdie affair, it may be that publishers will begin to censor things covertly, and writers will begin to censor themselves covertly more than before. Maybe not. We'll see. Okay, one last question. Yes?
Are you interested in the writer who isn't talented and serious like Rushdie, and perhaps not under a sentence of death, whose book, lousy book, is withdrawn because of mild pressure? Is that? I'm trying to elicit what's the serious principle.
Well, we have mechanisms in place. For instance, Penn, which I was president of for a few years ago, and Susan Sontag's been a very effective president for the last couple of years. We have mechanisms there. We protect authors whose books, all over the world, and also in America, authors whose books are withdrawn for insufficient reasons. And to a degree, we're respected in that world. And, you know, we're one force out there along with other forces, and sometimes we have effect. But the real problem always is not, what do you do with this? This is not a TV debate subject. Let me end on this note. It's not something that you can say, take one side and take the other, and what do we find, and how are we going to find a solution to this problem? It's not a problem. It's a faith. And the faith is that if you have everybody saying what they want to say, you're going to be better off than if you have all sorts of rules on how people are going to be able to say it. And this is a faith, that, like any other faith, this is a faith that can create disasters. But it, what we discovered over the course of the Rushdie affair is that this was our faith. And for someone who walked around for the last 20 years thinking, finally I live without faith, it occurred to me that I've been wrong, that I had a faith keeping me going all these years, and that was it. Thank you. Good night.